Headlines: Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is paying an official visit to Iran with the expansion of bilateral trade and political ties on the agenda of his talks in Tehran. An international coalition of journalists slams the UK's decision to extradite Julian Assange to the US, calling for his immediate release. Also ahead, the Ecuadorian government refuses to end the state of emergency after 18 police officers go missing following an attack by indigenous protesters. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov is in Iran on a two-day official visit as Tehran and Moscow seek to boost ties in the wake of Western sanctions on both nations. Upon arrival, the top Russian diplomat met with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. Lavrov will also meet with other senior officials, including his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The talks will revolve around bilateral relations, the 2015 deal, the situation in Syria and Afghanistan, as well as the Ukraine crisis. The Iranian government has time and again stressed that promoting ties with neighbors is its foreign policy priority. Iran's judiciary says three agents linked to the Israeli spy agency Mossad who were plotting to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists were arrested 2 months ago. The prosecutor general of Sistan and Balochistan province says the detainees have confessed that they were in direct contact with Mossad agents. The three, whose nationalities have not been made public, will soon be put on trial. According to the official, their detention followed months of complicated intelligence operations. A thorough investigation is currently underway into their case. Israeli footsteps have been traced to the assassination of several Iranian nuclear scientists, the most recent one being Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran 2 years ago. Iran has pledged a crushing response to any acts of Israeli adventurism. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas says the detention of Israeli spy agents behind an assassination plot is another successful operation by Iran's intelligence apparatus.
But it seems that over the last 2 years or so, at least, the Islamic Republic of Iran has also been giving robust responses. But in this instance, it's yet again a case of the Iranian intelligence services breaking the Mossad network. Now, these are obviously, in the overall scheme of things, quite futile Israeli operations. I mean, they've tried sabotage assassinations of nuclear scientists before, and we, of course, you mentioned Mossad Fakhrizadeh, but also there was the quantum field theorist Masoud al-Mohammadi, who was just one of many they got away with at one time. You know, the Islamic Republic's intelligence services, though, have increasingly been becoming more and more adept at finding these networks. They did not just with the Mossad on this occasion. They've also done it with, for instance, the CIA agents between 2010 and 13 that were all caught with their operations in Iran.
Israel continues to step up its propaganda war against Iran, but Iran's military is not having any of that and has dismissed the regime's latest efforts in forming an alliance against the country. Not only have similar efforts like forming an Arab NATO have failed when it comes to Iran, but Israel itself is now in a state of emergency with a political coalition that's falling apart.
Iran has dismissed the latest Israeli efforts to form an anti-Iran alliance as desperate attempts. Abu Fazl Shekarchi, who is a spokesman of the Iranian armed forces, made the remarks after Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, claimed that the regime is building a US-sponsored regional air defense alliance in cooperation with some regional Arab states to foil what he described as Iran's attacks. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Navy has already warned neighboring countries against allowing Israelis into the Persian Gulf, saying such a move would bring nothing but chaos and instability to the region. Tehran says if a country allows the Tel Aviv regime to establish a foothold in the West Asia region, that country and the entire region will be inflicted with insecurity, chaos and instability. Israel has been making attempts to draw closer to US-aligned Arab countries in the Persian Gulf in recent years.
And Israel and Saudi Arabia are America's main conduits for Washington's influence and power in the region. So as long as American power remains formidable in the region, even though it has declined, as long as it remains formidable, the Middle East will continue to be the most volatile part of the world.
Benny Gantz has recently unveiled what he dubbed the Middle East Air Defense Alliance and said the regime's cooperation with Arab states is already underway. The plan is reminiscent to an earlier scheme by US allies in this region known as the Arab NATO. The plan, which was pushed by Saudi Arabia and the US administration of former President Donald Trump, failed to materialize and the result was disastrous.
The dynamics of the Middle East have changed quite significantly in recent years, in that Israel, while remaining immensely powerful in political, economic, and military terms, has lost much of the clout that it once wielded in the region. And it is my contention that is on account of how the Israeli state's foremost patron, the United States of America, has lost influence and has lost power in West Asia.
Iran has warned Israel more than once that when it comes to the regime building a U.S.-sponsored regional air alliance in cooperation with some regional Arab states, it has also warned the neighboring countries against allowing Israelis into the Persian Gulf, saying that would bring nothing but chaos and instability to the region.
Israel's threat and warmongering rhetoric against Iran come amid unprecedented political instability in the regime itself. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has submitted a bill to dissolve parliament as his fragile coalition cabinet collapses, triggering the path for a fifth round of elections in 3 years. Bennett will become the shortest-serving premier in the regime's history after serving 12 months and 1 week, and Lapid will act as the interim premier, Israel's 14th prime minister, until the next election, likely to be held on October 15th. The fragile 8-party coalition was formed in June 2021 after 4 successive inconclusive elections. The ideologically divided alliance included right-wingers like Bennett, Lapid's centrist Yesh Atid party, left-wingers, and for the first time in Israel's history, lawmakers from an Arab party. Israel's rising anti-Iran threats is seen as an attempt to divert public attention away from the regime's dismal political and security failures. Furthermore, the geopolitical reality of the region is changing fast. The US is in a much weaker position following its disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan and setbacks in Iraq. The resistance front is also in a much stronger position. Syria has overcome military pressures and is now fixing its ties with once hostile Arab nations. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has received the credentials of the Bahraini ambassador nearly 6 months after the Persian Gulf Kingdom appointed its first ambassador to Damascus as the two countries moved to shore up diplomatic ties that were downgraded in the foreign-sponsored conflict in Syria. Iran, which is seen as the backbone of the resistance front, has already warned that it would give a crushing response to any hostile move.
So Turning elsewhere, search and rescue operations are ongoing in Afghanistan after the deadliest earthquake in 20 years rocked the country's east earlier in the day. Several UN agencies have rushed to help Afghans after authorities there called for international assistance. However, the UN's humanitarian agency says it is scrambling to get emergency shelter, trauma care, and food aid to the affected areas. It says heavy rain and wind are also hampering search and rescue efforts, while helicopters are unable to land. The 6.1 magnitude quake has killed some 1,000 people and wounded hundreds of others in Paktika and Khust provinces. The toll is likely to rise. The World Health Organization and the UN Children's Agency have also extended assistance to the affected areas. Iran's Red Crescent Society has already expressed its readiness to supply aid. Afghanistan's deadly earthquake has once again brought the plight of Afghan people to the fore. The Taliban government is now urging the U.S. to release the country's frozen assets. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid also asked Afghanistan's neighbors for relief aid. He said the government is mobilizing all available facilities and financial assistance to help people in the quake-stricken area. Mujahid added that international aid organizations, that is, and Afghanistan's neighbors, including Iran, have indicated their readiness to help the country. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has condoled with the families of victims, saying Iran's aid shipments will be sent to Afghanistan as soon as possible. The UN says Afghanistan needs an estimated $15 million in emergency relief aid. The country is reeling from two decades of U.S. occupation that worsened poverty and the humanitarian situation there. The UN says more than 23 million Afghans face acute hunger, and 97% of the country's population will plunge into poverty in 2022. Tawab Savarsai is a freelance journalist who joined us earlier from Kabul. He explains why the quake in Afghanistan has caused so many casualties.
It is one of the biggest disasters that happened since long years. Because Afghanistan is not prone to earthquakes, so this is one of the biggest earthquakes. And as it happened during nighttime, that everybody was at home and sleeping, so that's why it causes more damage. And the recent rains that since last 3 or 4 days, that it's pouring heavy rains. And due to that, plus the other factor is that most of the homes outside the big cities in Afghanistan are made of mud. That's why it causes more damages.
Moving on, an international coalition of journalists has slammed the UK's decision to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US as a flagrant violation of human rights. During a gathering in the Swiss city of Geneva, the coalition described Britain's move as total contempt for freedom of the press and a serious threat to journalism. It also demanded London immediately release Assange and drop all charges against him. Assange has said he will appeal the UK's decision. He is wanted by the US for the publication of confidential files in 2010 and 2011. The files revealed how US-led forces killed civilians in unreported incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tensions are escalating in Ecuador following days of anti-government protests. Officials say the state of emergency will remain in place after 18 police officers went missing following an attack by indigenous protesters. The officers were reported missing after their station in the eastern Amazon city of Puyo came under attack. Two people have died in the 10-day protests following violent clashes between protesters and security forces. The government has declared a state of emergency in 6 of Ecuador's 24 departments, around 90 civilians and 100 members of the security forces have been injured in clashes. Six others have been seriously injured and three more detained by the protesters. According to the latest reports, protesters have taken control of Puyo, with the government trying to retake control of the city. Protesters are angry at rising fuel prices and the economic policies of President Guillermo Lasso. The French president is in hot water after his party loses the majority, after his party loses, that is, the majority in Sunday's parliamentary elections, and now Emmanuel Macron is asking political groups to make compromises and end the political deadlock caused by his failure.
Oui. Pour agir.
To act in your interest and that of the nation, we must collectively learn to govern and legislate differently. We must build new compromises with the political groups that make up the new assembly, based on dialogue, listening, and respect.
Macron, however, ruled out any attempts to create a government of national unity that would include all political forces. Macron said such a move is not justified. He admitted that there are deep divisions in the country. Macron called on the opposition parties to leave infighting behind and move beyond politics. Earlier this week, the new left-wing alliance, NUPES, which is now the main opposition force along with its allies, said it will bring a motion of no confidence vote against the Macron government next month. Macron's centrist alliance won most parliamentary seats in the election, but fell 44 seats short of a straight majority. French media have called the results a slap in Macron's face. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As food prices and hunger surge worldwide, hundreds of millions of people around the globe are marching towards starvation, increasing the likelihood of preventable deaths, civil unrest, and political violence in the month ahead, the United Nations food chief warned recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN Food Chief Says Hell on Earth Looms from Hunger Crisis. Here's the details. As food prices and hunger surge worldwide, hundreds of millions of people around the globe are marching towards starvation, increasing the likelihood of preventable deaths, civil unrest, and political violence in the month ahead, the United Nations food chief warned recently. Speaking from Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, World Food Programme WFP Director David Beasley said that frightening shortages of key food staples put tens of millions of lives in jeopardy and risk destabilizing countries that are heavily reliant on imports. Even before the Ukraine crisis, we were facing an unprecedented global food crisis because of COVID and fuel price increases, said Beasley, adding, then we thought it couldn't get any worse, but this war has been devastating. The crisis in Eastern Europe disrupted this year's planting season, raising fears that this summer's harvest, assuming sufficient labor power and storage space can be found, will be a third lower than in 2021. Consequently, food prices have soared to record highs, surpassing levels last seen during the global crisis of 2007 to 2008. When a spike in the cost of bread and put tens of millions of people at increased risk of extreme hunger. Citing the increased cost of shipping, fertilizer and fuel associated with the COVID-19 pandemic, the climate crisis and the crisis in Eastern Europe, Beasley said that the number of people suffering from chronic hunger has grown from 650 million to 810 million over the past 5 years. Meanwhile, the number of people suffering from shock hunger, which Beasley defined as not knowing where your next meal is coming from, has ballooned from 80 million to 325 million over the same time period. A report published earlier this month by WFP and UN Food and Agriculture Organization made clear that conflicts, increasingly extreme weather stemming from fossil fuel-driven climate emergency, and the lingering economic impacts of the coronavirus crisis, prolonged by inequitable access to vaccines, tests, and treatments, are also exacerbating food insecurity. Responding to the report, which warned that an all-time high of 49 million people in 46 low-income countries are now at risk of famine, U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar said earlier this week that this should be the biggest story in the world right now. As the global hunger crisis grows more severe, the UN's capacity for addressing the unfolding humanitarian disaster is being diminished simultaneously. WFP sources 70% of the wheat for its emergency relief programs from Russia and Ukraine. As a result of the crisis in Eastern Europe, the WFP's operating costs have skyrocketed by $70 million per month, forcing it to slash rations by as much as half in several nations. According to the UN's recent report, of the nearly 50 million people at risk of famine globally, 750,000 are already in catastrophe, the most dire phase of the food insecurity scale. People in Ethiopia, Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan and Yemen, war-torn and drought-stricken countries that import large quantities of wheat from Russia and Ukraine, are among those experiencing the worst acute hunger. Another hot spot mentioned in the report is Afghanistan, whose central bank reserves have been seized by the Biden administration. Referring to the crash that started in 2007 and culminated in bread riots in dozens of countries, Beasley said that the economic factors we have today are much worse than those we saw 15 years ago. Failing to confront the current crisis, he warned, would lead to famine, destabilization of nations, and mass migration. We are already seeing riots in Sri Lanka and protests in Tunisia, Pakistan, and Peru, and we've had destabilization take place in places like Burkina Faso, Mali, and Chad, said Beasley, adding, this is only a sign of those things to come. It's very, very frightening time. Beasley continued, We are facing hell on earth if we do not respond immediately.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us contemplate on a wonderful aphorism from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Raza, peace be upon him, the eighth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. How many times has an hour of passion led to a long period of sufferings?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, self-purification. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that human self, our self, needs purification and needs to be refined and purified. And this is a fact which is religiously, intellectually, and socially, it's a known fact that our souls need purification. But there is a question here. Why ourselves need purification? Is there any deficiency, any fault, anything wrong about our nature that we need purification? The nature and essence of humans, no doubt that it's pure. There is no impurity, there is no kind of fault and deficiency in our souls. We have no such an aspect in our personality or in our essence that needs to be changed. So we in our core are pure, are beautiful. And that's why Quran says that human has been created on ahsani taqweem, best formation.
So our nature is pure, and our nature is good. Our nature is on the best possible form. So why, in the first place, we need purification? Is there really any need of purification? And what are the causes? Is there a natural cause, a natural problem in our formation? Or it's we who are damaged and create problems in our own selves, and that's why we need to purify ourselves. So it is a problem of, is it a problem of nature, or it's a problem of our own bad decisions? So this is the point which we consider and think about. Welcome back. This is A to Z. We were talking about self-purification. Yes, so there was a question, and that why we need purification in the first place. Is there any fault in our nature? We answered that there is no fault in our nature. Actually, we are purified and clear, and we have no fault in our basic nature. It's actually our own bad decisions which gradually develop bad habits in our personality. We get used to wrong things. The negativity which we create with our own actions needs to be purified. In our intellectual aspects, the wrong ideas, the wrong beliefs, in our psychological aspect, where there are bad habits and bad qualities which we develop with our own wrong decisions, they eventually end to a personality with bad habits and wrong qualities and vices that needs to be purified. And that purification means gradually clearing our own inner self from that negativity, that wrong actions, that bad habits, that negative aspects of our character, which are developed by our own bad decisions. So have you seen a garden without a gardener who does not care about the plants and flowers and herbs? With the passage of time, it becomes messy and the weak plants die and the stronger one takes a more and more place in the garden, and it becomes messy. And that's the point where a refinement, correction needs, when there is a corruption. Likewise, in ourselves, when we leave ourselves for emotions and passions to work, gradually we need purification. So it's because of our own decision. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala enable us to purify ourselves and clear ourselves from every impurity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community.
Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
A batch of autonomous delivery vehicles has been provided to facilitate personnel and volunteers in the streets and communities of Shanghai. The self-driving vehicles distribute supplies to residents in the Chinese megacity, which is now hit hard by the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The vehicles reduce person-to-person contact and largely lower the risk of infection. A community served by the distribution station has more than 30 apartment buildings and nearly 3,000 residents. The weight of each order is more than 5 kilograms, which puts great pressure on the volunteers to deliver. 49 autonomous delivery vehicles have been sent to communities, colleges, and hospitals in Shanghai to support anti-pandemic and supply work.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future.
Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
About a dozen penguins have been returned home after being given a second chance at life following their rehab in Argentina. The birds were rescued in the province of Buenos Aires and were transported to the Mundo Marino Foundation for evaluation. The Magellanic penguins were treated for malnutrition, dehydration, and parasites. The foundation's director says these pathologies are usually caused by climate change, food scarcity, and environmental pollution. Vets say they are seeing more and more of these sorts of rescues. The bears were nursed back to health in one of the foundation's facilities in the town of San Clemente del Tuyo. They were later released back to their habitat in southern Chile. People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand, and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's cultural heritage list last year.
Artists have turned a historic village in the Tunisian island of Djerba into a vibrant open-air art museum. The organizer of the project says he has always had a clear vision for the gallery.
The goal of this project is to create a new way of displaying urban art, to create a museum, a real museum, which labels for the works with a certain lighting, certain works and staging. Also to create a dynamic to give this museum to the residents so that they could appropriate it and it almost becomes their business.
The project is called Djerbehud and it's located in a town of Eriyadh. Since 2014, about 150 artists from 35 different nations have gathered there to produce eye-catching street art. Tourists say they enjoy visiting the gallery because they can see something new every time they come round. Residents of the town are also content with the vibrant looks of their streets, saying the artwork give a little movement to their everyday lives. Japanese engineers have invented a four-legged robot that can easily move across rough terrain while carrying heavy loads. Japan's Kawasaki Heavy Industries has developed a quadrupled robot, believing it can help with labor shortage in the country's aging society. Dubbed Bex after the wild goat species Ibex, the robot features large curved horns. It can walk over rough terrain or move faster on smoother surfaces using wheels tucked in its underbelly. Bex was designed to perform tasks and carry humans in agricultural settings, thereby answering a labor crunch in rural Japan.
Another breakthrough in the world of science. Japanese scientists move one step closer to creating lifelike robots by changing their physical appearance. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have developed living skin on a robotic finger. To that aim, they have submerged the robot's finger into a cylinder filled with a mixture of the natural skin components. The lab-grown skin is water-repellent, has wrinkles, and can heal itself. A member of the research team explains how the innovation will be helpful in the future. Let's take a listen.
As for challenges in the future, since we've only produced a simple skin, we would like to add various sensory organs such as the nervous system and the vascular system. We would like to further improve the function of the skin. Once we complete that, I believe that the skin itself could be used for transplantation, or use the skin as a model to develop cosmetics or drugs, or for leather products that do not require harming the animals, or to cover prosthetic limbs and legs.
The lab-grown skin is much weaker than the natural type. It's unable to survive long without nutrient supply and waste removal. For now, the team plans to address those issues and also include more sophisticated features. They want to add hair follicles, sweat glands, and sensory neurons to the skin. A Belgian company is trying to combat urban waste by transforming used coffee grounds into edible mushrooms that can also be used in construction. The mycelium is grown in a damp cellar in Brussels. Some 5 tons of coffee grounds are collected each month from partner cafes. They are then mixed in drums where the oyster mushroom spores are added and mixed with straw in a sack. The mushrooms emerge from slashes in the sacks 15 days afterwards and are ready to be sent to shops for sales. The business owners say they are looking to expand their business and use coffee and mushrooms as an environmentally friendly alternative to plastic.
Each day we throw away a lot of coffee, and this coffee to be produced needs a lot of energy from the cultivation to the transportation to Europe, and it's just a pity not to use it more than a few minutes to drink a coffee.
The company has already tested out its fungus-based insulating tiles and received its first order of these tiles for soundproofing purposes. Jacket says they hope to produce 12 tons of the mycelium material per month when they gather enough investment. The business owner says there is no shortage of raw material as coffee is widely consumed in Belgium. Jacket says the innovation can dramatically cut down on plastic waste.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In a powerful warning on Thursday, 16th of June, the patron saint of the conservative legal movement, former federal appellate judge J. Michael Luttig, testified before the January 6th committee and pronounced former President Donald J. Trump and his allies a clear and present danger to American constitutional democracy. The article you're about to hear is an opinion editorial published by the Los Angeles Times. It has been written by Lawrence H. Tribe, a professor emeritus of constitutional law at Harvard University, Philip Allen Lacovara, a former deputy solicitor general of the United States and counsel to the Watergate special prosecutor who argued the case of United States versus Nixon, and Dennis Aftergut, a former federal prosecutor. The article is titled, "The insurrection won't end until Trump is prosecuted and disqualified from future office." In a powerful warning on Thursday, 16th of June, the patron saint of the conservative legal movement, former federal appellate judge J. Michael Luttig, testified before the January 6th committee and pronounced former President Donald J. Trump and his allies a clear and present danger to American constitutional democracy. As Judge Luttig knows better than most, this historic phrase generates an extraordinary constitutional power of government to act and a duty to do so. Judge Luttig's verdict should be understood as a plea for Attorney General Merrick Garland to proceed towards charging Donald Trump with federal crimes that the public record now amply establishes. Only then will this nation be able to move forward from the ongoing insurrection. Beyond the avalanche of documents and testimony pointing to Donald Trump's guilt and the principle that no one is above the law, there is an additional reason to indict Donald Trump for his multifaceted conspiracy in 2020 to override the vote. Upon a conviction for inciting insurrection or being an accessory to insurrection, Trump would be subject to disqualification from acquiring federal office. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment directs, "No person shall hold any office under the United States who, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same." There is ample evidence that Donald Trump's objective was the insurrection's success. Among that evidence was his three-hour delay in calling the attackers to go home and his vengeful tweet demeaning Vice President Mike Pence, after Trump knew that the savage invasion of the U.S. Capitol had begun. "That was pouring gasoline on the fire," testified former Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Matthews. Even without a direct charge of insurrection, allegations of such insurrectionist activities in an indictment for conspiring to defraud the United States or to obstruct the official proceeding of Congress or for seditious conspiracy might suffice for 14th Amendment disqualification if Trump were convicted. Holding Donald Trump accountable and disqualifying him from future office would not be a partisan act, but one needed to preserve the republic. Without a prosecution of Donald Trump, here are three things that seem sure to happen if he were allowed to run again and either be lawfully elected or succeed in installing himself in office despite defeat in the Electoral College, as he attempted to do in 2020. 1. The end of elections in which a majority of American voters choose their leaders. As Judge J. Michael Luttig put it at Thursday's hearing, the clear and present danger now is because, to this very day, the former president and his allies and supporters pledged that in the presidential election of 2024, if the former president or his anointed successor as the Republican Party presidential candidate were to lose that election, they would attempt to overturn that 2024 election in the same way that they attempted to overturn the 2020 election. Republican-controlled state legislatures are already institutionalizing election sabotage, with GOP election officials determining election results no matter the vote winner. More than a dozen election deniers, like Jim Marchant, who just won the Republican primary for Secretary of State in Nevada, are GOP nominees for Secretary of State and other election-controlling positions. So even though Donald Trump won't hold the levers of presidential power in 2024 the way he did in 2020, he won't need to. His allies and his disinformation are putting officials in place around the country who will certify his win, whatever the vote. Two, the use of military for domestic control. The Trump administration deployed military helicopters in an unprecedented show of military force over peaceful demonstrators whom police attacked in Washington's Lafayette Park in July of 2020. Retired U.S. military leaders excoriated the abuse of power. In early December 2020, Donald Trump's close ally, his former national security advisor and retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, reportedly urged Trump to declare martial law in the United States. On 9th of November 2020, Donald Trump fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper and installed a more compliant Christopher Miller. On 4th of January 2021, Christopher Miller issued a memo requiring his approval to deploy the National Guard in Washington, D.C. On 6th of January 2021, Defense Department leadership delayed the National Guard's response to the Capitol siege by 3 hours. You don't have to be a clairvoyant to imagine how military force against political foes and restraint of force to protect violent supporters will be used if Donald J. Trump regains office. And three, the end of accountability. On 17th of June this year, in Nashville, Tennessee, Donald Trump said that if re-elected, he would consider very, very seriously pardoning all of the participants in the 6th of January insurrection. That could clear more than 310 insurrectionists who have pleaded guilty or been convicted at trial. Deterrence of future violence depends on judicially imposed sanctions. Donald Trump would remove them, signaling that violent extremism in defense of Trump is no vice. If he returns to the White House, he will install his people in the Justice Department and turn the machinery of prosecution against his political enemies and towards protecting his friends and his schemes. and should Donald Trump get an encore, look to pre-World War II Germany for a mirror. A failed coup d'etat in 1923 taught Adolf Hitler a better route to dictatorship just 9 years later. Those who